This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is global warming unstoppable now? Could we be saved by total economic collapse? If so, should we help civilization fall?
I think that undermining or sabotaging the economic growth machine is a fundamentally good thing.
It's another cheery edition of Radio EcoShock, with your darkness at the end of the tunnel, Alex Smith. Last night, I recorded another glimpse of the climate apocalypse with the author of Climate Wars, Gwyn Dyer. He outlined the short distance from here to the cliff where long-known natural feedbacks, leading to runaway global warming, start out and continue on for millennia. That limit is known as 2 degrees. Beyond that, great forests melt into fire, liberating their carbon. Beyond that, the Arctic permafrost melts, likely doubling atmospheric greenhouse gases at least. 5 to 7 degrees centigrade of average global temperature rise. Utter disaster. Dyer says world governments quickly agreed to the 2-degree limit at Copenhagen without telling the public why. No need to panic the herd. He says we won't make it in time before the big climate switch is pulled. You'll hear clips from that speech in an upcoming EcoShock show. Rising up early this morning, I tune into a climate science webcast from the Center for American Progress. Two top American IPCC scientists, trying not to say too much. Later in this program, I'll have a few clips and comments from that update, hosted by Joe Rome of the blog climateprogress.org. But we'll start out with a very different sort of scientist. Cloud specialist Tim Garrett stepped in a few people's faces when he proposed a formula about carbon and the world's wealth. Simply put, unless our economy collapses to levels that you and I would hate, climate change is unstoppable. Garrett bases his jarring statements on a basic law of physics, of thermodynamics. You won't need a science degree to understand our Radio EcoShock interview. Following Garrett, we dive deeper into the culture of despair. Keith Farnish is the author of Time's Up, An Uncivilized Solution to a Global Crisis. Are you ready to become uncivilized? If collapse is the best solution, would you help kick the system over? Or would you just watch it fall? Farnish has been called a terrorist and a green realist, your brain exercise for troubling times coming up. But let's start with the science of collapse. Maybe energy conservation isn't enough. What if global warming is already an unstoppable force? Is economic collapse one of our only hopes? These disturbing questions arise in a controversial study by Tim Garrett, an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi. Well, can you give us the title of your new paper and where people can find it?
The title of the paper is, Are There Basic Physical Constraints on Carbon Dioxide Emissions? And the article can be found on my website, perhaps most easily, which is easily found by either Googling Tim Garrett or going to the Atmospheric Sciences page at the University of Utah, or it can be found through the journal Climatic Change.
Okay, and I'll toss in a link to your webpage in my blog for this program. Well, look, I understand you applied some basic physics to the way our civilization works. Can you explain your theory for us?
Sure. I think the concept is easily understood in the light of perhaps looking at a growing child. And this is a familiar analogy, perhaps a good place to start, because if we think about a growing child, a child consumes energy, as does an adult, in order to maintain daily operations of that child. But what is a bit different with a child is that as the child uses the energy, it uses energy not only to maintain its current size, but also uses some fraction of that energy in order to grow its current size. And if it does that efficiently, then it is able to grow faster and thereby consume more energy rather than less energy in the future. And it's a very simple physical concept. It can be written down with basic thermodynamic arguments using equations. But as I showed, it can also be applied to civilization as a whole, treating civilization as being an energy-consuming organism. And if that is done, then it turns out that there is a very simple relationship between the rate of energy consumption by civilization as a whole and its economic value. It turns out that money is power, where power is the rate of energy consumption. There is a simple relationship of about 10 milliwatts per inflation-adjusted $1990 dollar. And that's really the key result, I think, that leads to the other results that I found in the paper.
And one of those was a suggestion that alternative energy like solar may not actually help stop climate change. And I've heard those doubts from other scientists and from an economist like Britain's Tim Jackson. So growth, even green technology, could just mean more energy is consumed. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the green technology, I think, is a slightly separate issue from the growth itself. The society will consume energy and probably try to maximize its growth regardless, whether it's green technology or not green technology. Perhaps the difference between green technologies and other types is that some of these green technologies aren't associated with carbon dioxide emissions. But as I pointed out, in order just to stabilize carbon dioxide emissions, just as we might talk about stabilizing carbon dioxide emissions in a growing human being, because we all breathe out carbon dioxide, the switch to non-CO2 emitting power sources would have to be very rapid, about 2.2% per year. So that works out to, just as an easy metric, one nuclear power plant per day.
Wow. Well, I don't think we're about to build a nuclear power plant per day, so we'll get in just a few minutes, I think, to what the other alternative could be. But I wanted first to raise the question, to everyone's surprise, you've said that we don't even need to calculate population growth or even the spread of higher living standard to know how things will go, that this energy is the key factor. That seems a bit hard to believe.
Yeah, it might seem hard to believe, but I mean, it's not that standards of living and population aren't part of the energy consumption by civilization. Obviously, people consume energy in commensurate to their standard of living. But the point is that our standard of living and how many people there are on the planet is really just a consequence of past energy efficiency. So, to think about it another way, coming back to the growing child, I don't need to think about the cells, the number of cells in the child, or how much energy each cell consumes to know that the child will grow. And I can look at how much energy the child is consuming to get an idea of how fast the child will continue to grow. I don't need to know the details.
I understand. Well, you've also described civilization as a heat engine. Could you enlarge on that?
Well, I think that's the basic idea. A heat engine is, well, it's a very familiar concept in thermodynamics or in physics. You just, everyone learns about it in their physics degree, if that's the path they take. And normally a heat engine was, well, the idea was first coined in the 1800s when people were thinking about digging up coal or whatever it was. And you pop coal into an engine, and then it would do mechanical work to lift something or move something. In the case of civilization, we aren't trying to lift some external object. When we consume energy, we consume energy to do work for ourselves. So it's a slightly different heat engine than is a normal conception. Here there's a feedback loop. If we consume energy and do work with that energy, that work is done to enable us to consume more energy in the future. So there's a feedback that leads to growth in this situation, rather than just simply work being done on some external agency.
And meanwhile, our politicians continue to call us back to a growing GDP. That sounds like our carbon emissions will never really go down if that happens.
Well, in fact, if it's a growing GDP, that not only corresponds to accelerating growth of carbon dioxide emissions, but actually an interesting mathematical form, which is a super exponential growth. So it's not just exponential growth, but it is the exponent of an exponent. So emissions are not only accelerating, but the rate of growth is accelerating as well. And that's just an unavoidable consequence of a growing GDP.
And that's pretty believable when we hear about what's happening in China and India and all around the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's always a constant surprise. You see reports where the people who are measuring the CO2 are constantly surprised that CO2 emissions rates have continued to accelerate even when the scientists are hearing dire economic forecasts.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, and we're about to explore whether economic collapse is the best way to save the biosphere, because we've talked about nuclear power. We need a new atomic plant every day, and that doesn't seem likely in time to avert catastrophic climate disruption, in my opinion. So that leaves economic collapse, and some deep greens, as you know, Tim, have called for this, but you're among the first academics that I know of to publish a peer-reviewed paper saying collapse may be necessary to save a habitable planet. Or am I putting words in your mouth? Maybe you didn't say quite that.
Well, not quite that, but that's what I did say is that if we are to ever stabilize emissions, that necessitates rather unpalatable, let's say, economic implications. If we are just to stabilize emissions, and I think this is a bit counterintuitive at first, but if we were just to stabilize the emissions, not so that they're decreasing, but just to stabilize them, the economy would have to be zero, adjusted for inflation. That does not mean that there wouldn't be economic activities going on, simply that none of these economic activities would add to the value of civilization. They would always be compensated for by some inflationary pressure. Now, I don't know what that world would look like. I've never lived in a world like that, but perhaps we can imagine by looking at some recent situations in places like Zimbabwe, where they ended up with hyperinflation, and it was a very different sort of life than we are used to ourselves in North America.
And so you looked at past development of civilization and applied your formula. Can you take the same formula and try and measure out how deep and how bad this collapse would have to be? I guess you've sort of expressed it right now, but could you enlarge on that, on what it would take to bring our carbon back to, say, 350? Can we figure that out?
Wow, I did run this once, and with some extremely drastic scenarios, I was able to see the model settle out at about 450 parts per million. But that would mean virtual complete economic collapse within my lifetime. I cannot imagine how it would be possible to get down to 350 parts per million. It seems implausible.
I gather it was hard to get this paper published until it came out in late 2009. What has been the reaction so far?
Well, the reaction I've got has been, there's been a fair bit of interest from people, interestingly enough, who are proponents of the peak oil theory. So for the peak oil fans, of course, finding some sort of basic link between the economy and rates of energy consumption is a very useful thing, because then they can relate it to their own understanding of the size and depletion rates of geological reservoirs of oil. And so, you know, that's heartening. I mean, it's nice to have when someone's interested in it. And other colleagues have found some interest, too, in just the basic thermodynamic framework.
But nobody's been too negative about it?
No, not at all. In fact, all the response I've got has been encouraging. I think a lot of people have long had a suspicion that statements that increasing energy efficiency will lead to reduced energy consumption something's quite obviously wrong with that, because it runs counter to our experience. We've been increasing energy efficiency throughout history. And
yes, you mentioned Jevons' Law, I believe it was?
Yeah, Jevons' Paradox, that's it. Yeah, I mean, Jevons was an interesting guy. He was extremely insightful, I think a bit too serious for his own good. He died at a year early age, I think, because he stressed himself out worrying about things. But yeah, he had this very insightful comment about the introduction of the steam engine, James Watt's steam engine, in the late 1800s. And he was saying this was, you know, a major efficiency gain, and it led to increased coal consumption rather than less coal consumption. And he made a very emphatic argument that any argument to the contrary was completely wrong.
And as I learned from your website, your real specialty is clouds. And listeners, you can find that link, as I say, to Tim Garrett's website in the Radio EcoShock blog for February 4th, 2010. In my opinion, Tim, clouds are one of the last great frontiers of unknown science. Do you foresee a time when humans could control the clouds? And if so, should we?
There's actually a history to trying to control clouds. And even today, people try to engage in something called cloud seeding, where they tried to add silver iodide pellets to clouds in the attempt to accelerate their production of rain. Of course, this has agricultural benefits, and actually the field started with out of military interest. And it's been largely discredited simply because the amount of energy in a cloud is immense. It's something like many nuclear bombs going off at once. It's a huge amount of energy. You could power all of civilization if you could harness the energy off a few big clouds. So to imagine that we can control clouds seems a bit fanciful to me. And I know there are people who talk about it, but I'm highly skeptical.
Well, some have mentioned it as a form of geoengineering, as an alternative way to control the heat that reaches the Earth, but you don't really see a future for that in the near term.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my research is based on the ideas that these people are proposing, which are that if we add aerosol to clouds, then that will make them brighter and reflect more sunlight. And my belief is that we may make the cloud brighter here, but that would necessitate things becoming darker somewhere else, and that it would all be a wash once you consider the planet as a whole.
Right. Well, you know, Tim, I'm personally very resistant to recommending collapse as a solution. Billions of people would be hurt and likely many would die. And I'm enjoying our civilization, including talking to you right now long distance. So how do you personally handle the ugly possibility that we may be at peak wealth right now with a downhill ride ahead of us?
Yeah, well, I have two young children, so it's on my mind. Yeah, I mean, we're along for the ride. We will see what happens. And in the meantime, I guess I figure enjoy life while we can.
What are you working on now, and what would you like to research in the future?
Well, right now I'm about to submit a paper on how the Arctic becomes polluted and how clouds remove pollution from the Arctic. But I would like to pursue more of this research on the thermodynamics of complex systems. I've applied this to all of civilization, and right now I would like to use the same sort of framework to understand the development, growth, and death of clouds. I think the same principles can be applied, whether it's to civilization, to clouds, to a child, or whatever it is. We all live and die by the first and second laws of thermodynamics, so these principles should be quite general.
It might be interesting to apply it to cities as well, since most of us are living in cities and there are huge thermodynamic flows happening in cities themselves.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, that hasn't been done quite from a thermodynamic standpoint, but it has been from a mathematical standpoint. And in fact, when I mentioned earlier the concept of super exponential growth, there has been a recent paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy. Well, I guess it's 2 or 3 years old now, that highlighted super exponential growth being one of the defining characteristics of successful cities.
Is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners as we wrap up here?
The main point from my perspective is that this is an interesting physics problem, and of course it has, you know, very personal aspects for all of us, but it's also interesting physics and it's fun to think about.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. Find this interview as a free MP3 download at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you, Tim. And I'm wondering, is it possible we could get together again sometime for a program on clouds themselves?
Of course.
I'd love to do that. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for being with us. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We've just heard Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, and let's take a quick review. His paper is titled, Are there basic physical constraints on future anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide? The basic thesis, tested against past industrial development, is that neither population nor standard of living have to be included in modeling predictions of climate change. Garrett concludes that civilization, as measured by gross domestic product, is directly related to the amount of carbon burned. More emissions, more wealth. Less emissions, less economic production. Here is the exact description of the theory from an abstract of Garrett's paper. Quote, "Here it is shown, both theoretically and observationally, how the evolution of the human system can be considered from a surprisingly simple thermodynamic perspective, in which it is unnecessary to explicitly model two of the emissions drivers, population and standard of living. Specifically, the human system grows through a self-perpetuating feedback loop in which the consumption rate of primary energy resources stays tied to the historical accumulation of global economic production, or P times G, through a time-dependent factor of 9.7 plus or minus 3 milliwatts per inflation-adjusted 1990 U.S. dollar," end quote. Well, that sounds a little complicated, but, you know, the end result of it is, by applying his formula, Garrett says it would take a new nuclear plant built every single day to keep up our current standard of living. As that isn't happening, and may be impossible anyway, the only other solution is economic collapse. In our interview, Garrett suggests a horrible economic crash, which I imagine is diving perhaps to medieval standards of life, is required just to stay at 450 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. In the conclusion of that paper, we find, quote, "Viewed from this perspective, civilization evolves in a spontaneous feedback loop, maintained only by energy consumption and incorporation of environmental matter. Because the current state of the system, by nature, is tied to its unchangeable past, it looks unlikely there will be any substantial near-term departure from recently observed acceleration in CO2 emission rates," end quote. And I'll let you get out of that what you can. Several science journalists picked up on the paper's underlying prediction, saying global warming is unstoppable unless the economic system crashes. And that leads to our next guest. He agrees and suggests it is our duty, all of us, to help the inevitable hard landing come sooner rather than later. Why wait until nature is totally used up on a nearly dead planet? What if civilization is a disease, fatal to life on Earth as we know it? That's the view of Britain's Keith Farnish, author of the book Time's Up, An Uncivilized Solution to a Global Crisis. You might not like what he has to say, or maybe you will. I'm Alex Smith, fearless host of Radio EcoShock. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Well, good. And I gather you tried Greenpeace for about 5 years, but got frustrated with that carousel of protests and then no real change.
Yes, there was only one action I ever did that was satisfying, and it was the only action that actually involved something really changing. The problem with most of the, and I'm not going to target Greenpeace in particular, only because I've got direct experience with them, but most of the mainstream environmental groups seem to think that you achieve change by going along with the status quo, by kowtowing to whatever system's in place. And of course you're going to achieve change relative to what's going on at the moment, but it's not significant. And if you, as we go on, I'm sure you'll realize that the kind of change that's required is certainly not the kind of change that groups like Greenpeace are looking forward to.
Well, you describe our current society as a culture of maximum harm. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I must admit that those aren't my personal words. I took them from the peerless Derek Jensen, who some of your listeners will be aware of. And Derek has written long time on the problems of civilization, particularly industrial civilization. The culture of maximum harm really is a way of describing how the system that we have tries to achieve its aims. And imagine that you're trying to get from one place to another. Most people would go from one place to another. They wouldn't really think about what they're damaging or the way that they're doing it in one particular way or another. the culture of maximum harm tries to achieve its journey by taking as much as it possibly can and by doing as much damage as it possibly can. And the reason it does this is because it has one primary goal, which is to achieve continuous growth, and that's economic growth in any terms of the phrase growth. And economic growth cannot be sustainable. So this culture, which I believe is unique in human history, is doing something that is uniquely destructive. In other words, it is the culture of maximum harm. It is the most harmful way that humans can exist.
One of your maxims is that corporations cannot be green. Why not?
A corporation, and this certainly does follow on from what I just said, a corporation exists in order to achieve economic growth. It exists in order to achieve profits. Worse than just an individual trying to make a bit of money, a corporation wants to ensure that it maximizes the amount of return for its shareholders. And in order to do that, it has to cause damage in some way. And it does that through a variety of methods. Either it keeps cutting corners, and those can be corners in environmental terms, so it could be ignoring environmental legislation, or it could be paying people as little as they possibly can, or it could be trying to do things as cheaply as possible in the dirtiest way possible, or it will try to make this profit by taking something that wasn't there in the first place. So to take an oil company as an example, you can't make something from nothing, but if you have a source of energy underground, then effectively you're taking something from nothing. You're taking that oil, you're going to burn it up. The act of burning it up makes you money, and that is essentially how a corporation runs and makes its profit, by taking something that it didn't have to put back in. Its corporations are never going to be sustainable by their nature because of the way business operates.
You also dismiss governments as any part of the solution. Why do you think politics has become so irrelevant?
Well, it's a very sad tale, but I think it goes back to the history of empire, and the British Empire is a very good example of this. Empire has been always intrinsically tied up with trade. The British Empire was a trading body. It was so large because it reached out to as many places in the world as had things that it could take. So Britain essentially owned India, South Africa, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and many other territories. I think that's a good example of how governments are tied up with industry. If you listen to any politician give a speech of any length, you will always hear the word growth. You will always hear the word economy. And that is because the primary role of a government within industrial civilization is to keep the economy growing. It's essentially no different to a corporation, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, but I don't believe that any government of any size exists in this society that isn't just like a corporation now.
Apparently NASA's James Hansen agrees with you in his review of your book on Amazon. He writes, and I quote this for listeners, "Keith Farnish has it right. Time has practically run out, and the system is the problem. Governments are under the thumb of fossil fuel special interests. They will not look after our and the planet's well-being until we force them to do so, and that is going to require enormous effort," Professor James Hansen of NASA. Keith, James Hansen is now taking a lot of flack from climate deniers and their ilk for saying that.
I'm not sure it's necessarily worrying him too much. He has been taking flack for at least the last 20 years from everywhere that possibly could give him flack. The coal industry hate him, the oil industry hate him, an awful lot of senators hate him. And when he stood up in front of the Senate in 1988 to essentially explain to the American government the potential horrors we were going to face from climate change, he was public enemy number one as far as the US government was concerned. So this is a little bit of a flash in the pan, but the words that are being used in relation to James Hansen and myself are certainly strong, I've been described as a terrorist, and by connection, so has James Hansen, words like genocide, eugenics. They've all been used in relation to my book and therefore in relation to James Hansen. Absurd, yes, because at no point have I ever said I want to kill anything off or destroy anything. It's I genuinely do feel for Hansen because he has put probably more than anyone else of himself into trying to achieve something which is completely dispassionate. It's altruistic. He's not doing it for himself. If he was doing it for himself, then he would be a businessman. And James Hansen doesn't make much money. He's an adjunct professor. He's a research scientist. He doesn't really have anything to gain from this, and he's lost an awful lot in terms of what he could have gone on and become a highly successful risk scientist, working for a corporation. He chose the other alternative. He chose to stick to pure science, objective science, and he gets hit a lot for this. And certainly, this isn't the first time, and this certainly won't be the last time he's going to get hit for this. I'm proud to call him someone that thinks in a similar way the way I do.
Well, getting back to your book, I think we all fear that our economic system is on life support. You've called for an end to industrialized civilization, saying it will fall apart anyway. Why should we help it go down, and wouldn't we be sabotaging our own way of living?
Well, we would be sabotaging the way of living that is highly destructive. It depends how dependent you are upon it. I believe that there are certain dependencies that we can do without. I'm not talking about immediately walking away and going off-grid and throwing away your job or anything like that. We've all got to live. We've all got to feed our families. We've all got to keep warm. We've all got to have a roof over our heads. And there are many situations in which people are tied to this system. So I would be reckless to say that you must abandon this immediately. However, economic growth is not something that can ever be sustainable. So essentially, by not having economic growth, what you're taking away is something that always takes, something that always destroys. And that's got to be a good thing. And I don't believe that not having economic growth will be destructive to anything but the systems of power that dominate the way we live. I think that undermining or sabotaging the economic growth machine is a fundamentally good thing. And some people have said and written that is effectively terrorism. Well, yes, in a way, because there is something, and I don't know what the term is used in the USA, but in Britain it's called critical national infrastructure. And the large financial organizations within the UK are protected under various laws, various security laws, and no doubt they're protected under the various Patriot Acts and other laws in the USA, because they are considered to be fundamental. They make money for the economy. It is a complete misnomer to place them in the same context as the kind of things that actively save people's lives, like medical services. Yet they are considered, these financial organizations are considered by governments to be just as important as medical services, as the water supply, as the food supply. And there's got to be something wrong there.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking about kicking it all over with author Keith Farnish. One key idea in your book, Time's Up, is that of connection. Can you describe that for us?
It's very difficult to describe any more than one's personal idea of connection, but I can give you an idea of the background. If you look at the way humanity has existed for hundreds of thousands of years, it has required a fundamental connection to the cycles and the processes that take place around the various groups and communities. These groups and communities wouldn't be able to survive if they didn't understand the cycles of nature, if they didn't understand the different ways that animal and plant life and other forms of biology existed for far longer than civilization has, are part of nature. They are deeply connected to the natural ecosystem. Civilization tries to pull us away from that. It gives us this alternative way of living which requires us to be disconnected. And what I've written about extensively in the book is that we have to become reconnected. Otherwise, I don't think that we can really understand how disconnected we've become. There's a myriad of different ways of connecting. It's unique to the individual. The writer Carolyn Baker talks about this in far more strident terms than I do, and she considers the idea of connection to be a deeply spiritual thing. And in a way it is, because it brings things out of you that most people, certainly people within civilization, haven't realized have been within themselves. So when you sit on a beach, or when you sit in the woods, or when you walk around and you listen, you really listen and really smell and taste and touch what's around you, then it does bring something out in yourself that is spiritual in a way. But that's the connection coming out. This is something that is fundamental to who we are as human beings. And unless we understand that deep connection between humanity and the rest of nature, then I don't believe we're in a position to really understand what we're doing to the world and how we can get back.
The next step, you say, is to focus on the tools of disconnection. What are some of the ways we become separated from real being and the natural reality?
I put down 10 tools, but there may be even more of these. It was really a way of making people understand the different ways that we live have all of them disconnected parts within them. So, for instance, some of the tools I've suggested are, for instance, the way that we're advertised to, this idea that we can have a wonderful way of living, but as long as it's in the same in terms that the corporations sell to us. There are other tools like authority, and if you look at the work of Stanley Milgram, for instance, in the 1950s, he demonstrated unequivocally that you could make people do whatever you want them to do, providing you have this chain of command, this form of authority. And authority is fundamental to the way that civilization works. You have a hierarchy. You look up to people. Some people look down upon others. But essentially, we play a part because there is this authority. But all of this is different. This is not connected to the real world. There's other tools of disconnection which are much more obvious, like abuse, physical abuse. You have military forces which are all around the world abusing people, are killing people. And if you look at, for instance, what goes on in China constantly, then whenever anyone steps out of line and goes against the status quo in China, then they are disappeared. They are taken out of the system, and because there is the potential that they may make other people realize that this isn't quite the way to live. This isn't quite the way that we should be going along with things. One of these tools of disconnection, which is particularly powerful, which unfortunately a lot of environmentalists are guilty of, is the idea of hope. And I think it was very, very telling that Obama used hope as his most powerful tool for looking towards the future. This message was coming from someone who is, to all intents and purposes, at the head of the system. He has some good intentions. However, the idea of giving someone hope takes away your ability to act. Rather than actually going out and doing something, if you can just be given enough hope, if you can be given the idea that if you hope enough, then things are going to get better, then it disables you. It stops you doing things. So I consider hope to be one of these tools of disconnection as well.
Paul Simon famously sang that there are 100 ways to leave your lover, and Keith Farnish, you've found over 100 ways to undermine the system. Can you give us just a couple of examples?
There's an article I have written on the Earth blog, which is, it's not complete yet, because I keep discovering all these little things. I want to be very clear that the idea of undermining the system is not about This is not about the things that have been written about in the blogs recently about destroying cities and blowing up dams and things like this. The undermining is about undermining these tools of disconnection. It's about giving people their freedom back. It's about giving people their minds back so they can reconnect. They can live in the way that humanity was meant to live. But there's lots of these ways, and one very easy example is simply turning televisions off. So if you can turn a television off in a public place, people actually realize, and I've experimented doing this in public places, people suddenly come back to their senses. They were blindly watching this screen, churning out adverts, and the TV went off. And I've got a remote control device that does this. And suddenly, they're looking around going, oh. And then they go back to their normal lives. But there's lots more of these things. You could subvertise advertising billboards, so writing things on billboards that actually go counter to the messages that the advertisers want you to do. You could send out fake press releases as a company representative, actually giving the truth about what the company are doing. So, press release, so-and-so company admits to environmental mismanagement. Well, of course, the company wouldn't do that, but of course, if you manage to do it and you make it look convincing enough, then you've undermined that company. But there are dozens and dozens of these things, and I think they're only limited by the imagination.
If I understand you correctly, a few people can start a trend that radiates into much bigger things. You speak of the power of pioneers and early adopters. Tell us about that.
The idea of stratifying society, for want of a better term, is it's really something that you see all the time. The concept is called diffusion of innovations, and it's just one of the ideas that I've touched upon, but you're always going to have these pioneers. You're going to have people that take up an idea, and they don't just agree with the idea, they actually act on it. So there are an awful lot of people out there, a surprising number of people, who are really taking the bit between their teeth and starting to live in ways that are far closer to the way humanity was meant to live. And there are other people who are a bit further up, they're a bit further on the timescale, and it's a larger chunk of people, these early adopters. And they may be influenced by these pioneers because they might be in the same peer group or the same social group. And so they're more likely to change than had these pioneers not been there. And then you have these much larger chunks of people, which are the bulk of society, the early and the late majority. And this is what you would probably call in America the middle classes. In Britain we call it middle England. The people who the governments are always trying to appeal to. This is going to come much later, these kinds of changes, but it can't happen unless these earlier groups start changing, I believe. And it's a little bit more complicated than that because you also need these connectors and mavens and salespeople, which people have read about in The Tipping Point. These things all fit together, as does the undermining, but you don't actually need millions of people to be actively changing to create change. As long as the momentum gets started up and is done in the right way, then quite fundamental change can happen with just a few people.
Suppose we hurry the process of crashing civilization. What do you picture happening next?
It's not a nice thing to think about, this idea of crashing civilization. There are various writers like James Kunstler, and Carolyn Baker, who I've mentioned, who are very much of the mindset that it's going to happen anyway, and it's going to happen soon. And in fact, it is happening as we speak. Certainly with the economy, we've seen a few of these effects of what happens when a mismanaged economy collapses and the people at the top continue to cream off what they want, but the people at the very bottom suffer the most. This is a symptom of the kinds of things that are happening at the moment. This is crash. Oil crises are going to happen. I believe we've reached the peak, the oil peak. You're going to have other kinds of peaks as well. You're going to have peak gas. You're going to have peak nuclear. And as the energy supplies run out, then you're going to get a strange situation which probably mimics what's happened with the economy, whereby the people at the top get what they want and the people right at the bottom suffer the most. And it's the people who are economically at the bottom who, and particularly urban people, who do tend to suffer most when anything like this does happen. I don't think you can be too explicit about this. If you're in a situation where you're going to suffer anyway because of any of these crashes, and they are going to happen, then you're the people who really need to gear yourself up for this situation. Read authors like Sharon Astick, who writes wonderfully about gearing yourself up for hard times, and try and get out of being so dependent on industrial civilization. It's not easy, but there's certain things you can do to simplify your life that can protect yourself against it. I don't want to cause a destructive crash. I want to somehow get to a situation where we're in control of this slow downfall of civilization. And I think that's a much kinder way of going through the motions of a collapsing civilization than just having these shock, this shock after shock after shock, which is going to happen as the economy and energy and water and all of these other things start crashing.
Where can people find your blog if they want to follow up on this?
Right, well, I've got a website that's got the whole book on, which is the unprinted version, and that's amatterofscale.com. I run something called the Earth Blog, which is theearthblog.org, and on this I publish various essays, which many of them have been extensions on what I've written. And there's also a site called the Unsuiter Blog, so that's just unsuiterblog.com, and it's starting to contain these ideas, these undermining tasks. It's been about greenwashing up to now, but I think we've got to start getting a bit active and start thinking about how to get round this system that tries to take everything away from us. So the Unsuiter Blog is going to get a little bit edgy in the future, and that's probably the one to keep an eye on.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We've been delving into deep green thought with one of Britain's more controversial thinkers, Keith Farnish. He's the author of the book Time's Up, An Uncivilized Solution to a Global Crisis, published by Green Books. Thank you so much, Keith.
Thank you, Alex.
You can find some links to Keith's blogs and his online book in my Radio EcoShock blog dated February 4th, 2010. Just go to ecoshock.org and click on blog. I've posted a few other goodies for you there as well.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
Webcasts are proliferating as various publishers and institutions slash their travel costs. That's good for emissions and a way to let many more people into the virtual room. I attended two this week, just for you. One was a reassessment of Copenhagen and the way forward from the British publisher Earthscan. There I met David Satherwaite, our radio guest next week. His recent work on the realities of human settlement, the slums, and Western consumerism fits in perfectly with the new World Watch 2010 State of the World report. I interview that report's project director, Eric Asadourian, as we ask, is it them or is it us? Next week on Radio EcoShock.
You have heard and seen enough negativity to last a lifetime.
My second webcast was provided by the Center for American Progress and hosted by Uber blogger Joe Rome. His spot, climateprogress.org, really is the indispensable climate blog, as Tom Friedman called it. On the webcast, we got to hear two top American scientists who have helped organize IPCC reports, Dr. Michael McCracken and Dr. Christopher Field. I'm not going to lie to you. At times, the webcast was timid to boring, as the two scientists were so careful about the limits of the IPCC process. You had to reinterpret wonk speak to realize this intergovernmental panel on climate change is really not up to the task of warning the world about the climate threat. Why not? Let me count out just a few reasons. One, the whole pile of summaries, the things you and I and politicians actually read, must be agreed to line by line by each and every government in the world. That means, for example, Saudi Arabia, the giant oil producer who often denies climate change, has to sign on. It's almost like having Dick Cheney approve everything the Obama administration does. Oh, wait, it seems like that's happening in the Senate anyway. 2. When incompetence and possible corruption, in the case of the Grand Leader Pachauri, show up, the IPCC has no agency to investigate it, to correct the problem, or even to handle the press. Pachauri was involved with the unscientific and botched prediction about the Himalayan glaciers melting by 2030, now shown to be contrary to the common knowledge of most glacier experts. A member of the team acknowledged they knew the information to be false, yet Pachauri helped get that wrong information into the report and then personally profited from the panic by the Indian government. His company got fairly big money to find out more about climate change, about a problem which did not exist at the levels claimed. It stinks of corruption, not a new idea at the United Nations. I posted a list of Pachauri's various businesses, and it's a long list, in my blog for this week. He should resign. None of this was mentioned by the upright scientists at the American Progress webcast. They admit a major mistake was made, but don't criticize either the man or the system that let him get away with it. Pitiful. 3. There are lots of things that science simply can't address that matter a lot. For example, when the assembled scientists realized they didn't know how to predict Arctic ice melt, they just left that out of the calculations on sea level rise. So their prediction of a few millimeters rise by 2100 was laughable. There's a lot more unknown unknowns, including public panic, climate wars, and climate trauma, to name just a few. Those demons are outside the realm of science, but definitely part of what we need to understand or at least plan out with the best guesses. 3. The IPCC is always 5 years behind current science. And why do we only report every 5 years on a problem that suggests we only have 10 years left to act, if that, before nature takes over control of the greenhouse? We need a permanent climate war room, or rather, a climate peace room. 4. Experience with past reports shows the IPCC always underestimates both the urgency, the timing, and the severity of the impacts of climate disruption.
It'll soon be over for you, the rest of us, the walking wounded. Must go on living for a while.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
You haven't heard?
Heard what?
The radio.
Here are a couple of clips from the webcast. First, Christopher Field echoes almost exactly the theory we heard in our first interview with Tim Garrett. Carbon equals wealth.
This is a figure over about two orders of magnitude of per capita carbon emissions on the vertical axis and per capita economic activity across the horizontal axis. And what you can see is that more or less independent of time, more or less independent of what part of the world you're in, there is a linear relationship in this log-log plot between carbon emissions and economic activity. The big issue in climate change for the future isn't how we deal with the current bucket of emissions. It's how we move from an environment where the world is regulated by this relationship to one where we can break the relationship between carbon emissions and wealth and, you know, enable people to aspire to their legitimate goals for economic advancement without coupling that with carbon emissions.
And here Field adds to a list of climate change impacts already begun by Michael McCracken.
Mike also mentioned heat waves. This is an interesting figure from a recent science paper by David Battisti and Roz Naylor, and it simply says, you know, if we take the average of all the climate models that were run in the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report and say, well, how should we think about summer temperatures relative to historical means? And the way they did it is they said, okay, in the period from 2080 to 2100, what's the frequency with which the summer temperatures are as high or higher than the warmest temperatures in the historical record? And in this figure, anything that's in the red colors has 90% of the future summers are warmer than the warmest on record. And you can see that for this A1B scenario, which is, you know, one of the kind of the middle of the road ones, not at all what we've been doing over the last dozen years, a very large fraction of the world has essentially every summer is hotter than the warmest summer on record, and there's very little of the world that doesn't have at least half of the summers hotter than the hottest summer on the record. Wildfire is another area where increasingly the science is well understood. This figure from a recent paper by Tony Westerling and colleagues shows the relationship between wildfires in the western U.S. and summer temperatures. Basically, what Westerling was able to demonstrate was the very strong control of wildfire probability based on the length of time between when the snow melts in the spring and when it snows again in the fall. We have a good projection of where droughts are headed. One of the frustrating outcomes of the latest round of model analyses is that, in general, the expectation with precipitation is that we get more rain where it already rains too much, and we get less rain where it doesn't rain enough. In this figure, you can see that the projected, the yellows and reds are projected decreases in precipitation focused on the southwestern U.S. The projected increases in precipitation are the blues and purples. They're focused on the northeast where, if anything, the problems we have with floods are already greater. Worldwide, this same pattern is true, that it's the areas that have lots of precipitation that tend to get more, the areas that don't have less. And of course, the important change in precipitation is that you tend to get more of the precipitation in extreme intense events and less in the sort of everyday a little bit of rain type events. This is a historical plot of the change in the frequency of precipitation events that are in the highest 1%, and you can see that especially in the Northeast there's been quite a dramatic increase in the amount of precipitation that occurs in these very heavy events.
And finally, Dr. Michael McCracken on everyone's nightmare, melting permafrost.
Until now, humans have emitted something like 500 billion tons of carbon to the atmosphere by deforestation and combustion of fossil fuels. That's really a lot. The amount of carbon that's frozen in permafrost is probably about 1,500 billion tons, about three times as much as we've emitted through all of human history. Large amounts of that permafrost are in the coldest parts of the world, unlikely to thaw in the near term, but quite a lot of it is in areas where the climate has already warmed dramatically and where future dramatic warming could result in losses of large amounts of permafrost. Some of the climate model calculations have more than half the permafrost disappearing by 2100. How much disappears is, of course, a function of how much the climate warms. And one of the things that's most intimidating about the high-latitude carbon stores is that we don't really know at what point they begin to lose so much carbon that we really can't shut it off. There was a really interesting series of papers published in 2008 showing that metabolism of this carbon, which is actually quite easily decomposed, it's basically easily decomposed plants that were frozen 20 to 40,000 years ago, generates heat. And that in many areas of the world, especially the windblown Yetima sediments across Siberia, which hold more than 500 billion tons of carbon, you can actually create conditions where the decomposition of this material occurs fast enough so that the heat generated by the decomposition sustains the thawing, even if the temperature doesn't continue to increase. And that represents another one of these classic tipping points where once you reach a certain level of decomposition, it's not clear how it will get shut off.
That's all from the webcast by the Center for American Progress, February 2nd, 2010. It was hosted by Joe Rome, superclimate blogger at climateprogress.org. Most of the talk about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was diplomatic and disappointing. The IPCC, and in fact the whole UN system for negotiations, is plainly not working. If anything, it may be working against us. Frankly, we need a new public body to measure and predict the climate threat in real time. Let scientists say what they can prove without censorship from Saudi Arabia, George Bush, or whoever. Maybe it can all be built as a knowledge machine on the Internet. Heaven knows who will fund and control it. Maybe some billionaire will care enough about the future to fund it and let it go without strings. Maybe we can find a few honest men and honest women. Something has to change, or we are toast. Can the public stomach the awful truth, or will we go down in a sea of denial and business as usual? It's almost to the point where the danger to the world as we know it might matter as much as the Toyota recall or who won the Oscars. I know that's a big claim. But that's the way I see it. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening.